Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The world we lived in last Monday is no more. The coronavirus has changed everything and promises to do so for a while. Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk about the economic impact of the virus and how you can position yourself to make it through the disruptions the virus will cause to our economy. But today, we will spend this hour answering your questions about the coronavirus and COVID-19. As Governor Cooper said on Friday,
people are worried about what all this means for their families, their jobs, their incomes, and their communities.
And last Friday, we asked you to begin submitting your questions, and boy, did you respond. We have pages of them, and we'll get to as many as we can. You can also send questions right now through email at charlottetalks, WFAE.org. Get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks or through Facebook. And we're also opening the phones. You can call us at 704-926-WFAE. We haven't given this number out in 20 years, so I'll do it again. 704-926-9323. To answer your questions, we've assembled a panel of experts. Dr. Ralph Barrick is an epidemiology professor at the UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health, whose research specializes in coronaviruses, emerging infections, virus pathogenesis, drug and vaccine development, and he joins us from studios at WUNC in Chapel Hill. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Mike.
Jonathan Studnick is in our studio. He's a deputy director of Medic, Mecklenburg EMS. He's a paramedic, but he's also has a PhD in epidemiology. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mike.
And Claire Donnelly is back with us. She's a regular guest now. She's our health reporter here at WFAE. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Before we go to listener questions, a couple of really quick questions for you, Doctor. This came across the AP yesterday afternoon, a clinical trial evaluating a vaccine designed to protect against the new coronavirus begins today. The first participant in the trial will receive the experimental vaccine this morning. That said somebody from the National Institutes of Health, because they're funding this, but they spoke anonymously because the trial has not been publicly announced, and it will take a year to 18 months to fully validate any potential vaccine. What, if anything, do you know about this test?
Well, there are two priority vaccines that are being developed by the NIH. One's the recombinant protein vaccine that's focused on the spike glycoprotein of the virus. That's the projections that irradiate out from the virus particle when you see the pictures of the coronavirus on TV or on the internet. The other's a messenger RNA-based vaccine that has shown promise for a variety of emerging viruses.
And you have been studying coronaviruses in general for years. How many different coronaviruses are there? Do we even know the answer to that question?
That's a great question. So the coronaviruses have probably been best reported and numbered in bat species, but only about 40 of the 1,300 that exist. And in general, in every single bat species, there's at least 6 to 8 different coronaviruses.
So you've been studying these coronaviruses for years and worrying and warning about their potential to spread to humans. You've also been working with samples of this coronavirus, the one that causes COVID-19 in your lab, since February the 6th. When you started this work, coronaviruses were known to cause little more than common colds in most people. Have there been varieties as dangerous as this SARS-CoV-2, that's the virus, have there been viruses as dangerous as that to humans?
Well, the 21st century has seen 3 new emerging coronaviruses in human populations. There's SARS coronavirus from 2003, which emerged in China from bats and caused about 8,000 infections and 800 deaths, so it had a 10% mortality rate. MERS, or Middle East Respiratory Coronavirus, emerged in 2012 in the Middle East and has caused about 2,600 cases with a 36% mortality. And then 2019, the kissing cousin of the 2003 SARS strain, which was called SARS-2 or COVID-19. That has caused somewhere around 170,000 infections across the globe, with the mortality rate is around 3%, with about 6,000 deaths globally.
Are you getting enough money to do what you do? Effectively.
So certainly the answer is we were well-funded before the SARS-2 strain emerged, and so we have just repurposed those funding. We've also received animal model contracts from the NIH. We've received some additional funding from NIH, and we have several pending supplements that probably will be funded shortly.
So we're going to go to listener questions in a second, but I want to talk about how fast this virus is spreading here and around the world. Early last week, we had, I think, 7 cases in North Carolina, with the number rising each day. As of yesterday, I think as of right now, there are 32. Is that right, Claire?
Yeah, the state updates their website by 11 a.m. every day. Mm-hmm. That's a new thing. And the case count right now is 32, yeah.
Last week in Mecklenburg County, we had 2 cases. Now we have 4.
Right.
I think there's one in Cabarrus County. Mm-hmm. Last time I checked, 3,204 cases around the country. No deaths have been reported from this virus in North Carolina.
Correct.
But I think 41 have died in the United States. Doctor, put the rapidity, if that's the right word, of this spread into context with other respiratory viruses. And did you and your fellow experts know just how quickly this virus would spread when you heard about it and learned about its characteristics?
So the reproductive rate of this virus is around 3. That means every single infected individual on average transmits the virus to 3 other individuals. That's complicated somewhat by the presence of what are called super spreaders. These are individuals who, for whatever reason, from biological perspective that we do not understand, they can transmit to dozens of people in a very short period of time. So I would say that the research community has known since about January 22nd or 23rd that this was going to be a global problem. And that was when the Chinese announced that they had community spread and that they had asymptomatic spread.
Did the government know? When did the government know?
The government would have known certainly at the same time.
Okay. Jonathan Studnick is with us. He's the deputy director of Medic here in Mecklenburg County, but he's also an epidemiologist. So you've got a double-edged sword here going for you. You said that you and your first responder partners know that this outbreak is different. When you say that, what does that mean?
Well, we've been paying attention to the outbreak over in China since the end of January, like our colleague at UNC said. And we know that we have to pay attention to these types of outbreaks very differently than our standard infectious diseases that we deal with every day due to the lack of immunity within the population. We have to take precautions to protect not only the public, but we have to protect our responders so that we maintain adequate staffing to all county services through this outbreak, first responder services being just one of them.
We've been hearing, the public, lay people have been hearing about this for months, obviously because of China, and none of us, I don't think, and I think I still don't understand how serious this is. I think we haven't gotten our heads around it yet, but last week things started to be canceled en masse. All these basketball games and Broadway shut down, and over the weekend church services were canceled. The police were going through the French Quarter in New Orleans in cruisers telling people to go home, get off the streets, get out of the bars. Mayor de Blasio in New York City is said to be considering a lockdown. I think no restaurants can open. They can only have takeout. All of that might be necessary, but all of this is happening at breathtaking speed. Why have we gone? I'm not sure which one of you to ask this, Jonathan or maybe Dr. Barrick. Both of you can take a stab at this. Why have we gone from life is normal to in 6 days, life is new, different, completely different?
Let me take a stab at this first. And, you know, I think there's a call to action that some of you may have heard on the news or social media. And what we are attempting to do today is flatten the curve.
Ah.
Right? And so I want folks to think about that visually as we talk about this. We have a couple of options as we live with this new virus in our community. We can be passive and let the virus sweep through like a wave through our community, and that's going to overwhelm our resources. Our hospital beds are full with patients that have the flu or normal conditions that need hospitalization today. And if we have a massive influx of patients with COVID-19 that require intensive care beds, require the services of a hospital, we're going to find ourselves in a really difficult situation. But if we can take steps today to begin social distancing, to begin changing our behaviors, to do simple things, wash your hands, use hand sanitizer, wash your workspaces, then we can flatten the curve. And if we can do that, a similar number of people may become infected, but at a rate that we can bear.
Dr. Barrick, you're the safest person on the show because you're in a remote studio, nowhere near us, and our studio is pretty cramped. So I think that Jonathan and Claire and I are breaking the rules because we're too close together. I would say
I don't know. About, we got about 6 feet.
I don't know, but I'd say it's about 3.5, maybe 4. But this virus is spread. Is it not spread by touching surfaces, or can you get it simply talking to somebody too close if they happen to have it?
So the main mechanism of spread is through large droplets.
Okay.
Large droplets, when you cough or sneeze, have a tendency to be too heavy to remain in the air for a long time. And so they settle on surfaces, and then they're picked up on your hands or your fingers and then typically inoculated into your nose. Since we I can't remember the number of times that human beings put the finger their fingers into their nose. But it's a lot. Hold on a second. Just kidding.
Only on NPR. So the fact that everything is closing and life as we know it has completely changed, Claire, this is it would seem to me to be a good thing because it really has gotten people's attention. I think what really got people's attention, who maybe only casually pay attention to the news, don't consume any news at all, is March Madness is canceled.
Right.
So from your reporting, do you know what the impact of this has been on people's consciousness about how they should act in
the
world?
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody is sort of now starting to say, oh, even though I, like millennials, are getting the brunt of this, as we often do. But now
well
that,
deserved.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, you as a millennial might have it with mild symptoms. You might not get severely sick. But the question is, who could you then pass it to, right? Mm-hmm. As my colleagues have been saying, if you, you know, if every person you're, if you're going to be infecting three people, right, then that is like going to exponentially increase. So trying to be careful about where you're going, who you're seeing. And there's talk, I mean, you're right about New York is closing bars and restaurants, takeout only. Chicago, similar thing. I mean, I think people are starting to take public spaces, large crowds very seriously.
So let's get to the listener questions. Maggie on Instagram, please talk about common symptoms and the key things we should look out for. Are there ways to distinguish COVID-19 symptoms from the common cold or the flu, for example? Doctor.
Oh, this is for me.
Yeah, it can
correct.
Be.
no problem.
And you have about 40 seconds.
So the principal symptom is fever over 100 degrees, followed by a dry cough, a feeling of not being able to catch your breath. Those are the three predominant symptoms. Some people, a small percentage, will have diarrhea. But I think that pretty much covers the major symptoms.
So those symptoms would not be present with the flu?
Those symptoms are oftentimes present with the flu. The main difference being that you have much higher mucus secretion.
Okay.
So you'll cough material up when you start coughing.
So we're coming right back from this break. And when we do, we have a ton of nothing but listener questions to get out of the way. And we'll get to as many as we possibly can at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're taking your questions about coronavirus. We have a ton of them that came in over the weekend. Dr. Ralph Barrick is with us, professor of epidemiology in the Gilling School of Public Health at UNC Chapel Hill, where he is this morning. Jonathan Studnick is in our studio, deputy director of Medic and an epidemiologist himself. And Claire Donnelly is our health reporter here at WFAE. Dana, on Instagram, how and why is this more serious than the flu? Jonathan.
Well, I think what Dr. Barrick said really resonates is the transmissibility, the fact that one infected person can infect up to three other people. And one of the large reasons for that is that we don't have any immunity to this.
There's That's not true of the flu. If I get the flu, people around me can't get it?
So because of the immunity that we have to the flu through routine vaccination and a decrease in the susceptible population to the flu, because of vaccinations and people having had the flu and recovered from it, the transmissibility of the flu is much lower than COVID-19.
And Dr. Barrick, is this – if we get this virus, is it harder on us because it's more virulent, if that's the correct word, or because we have no immunity to it because it's new?
It's a combination of both factors. So this particular virus has a age-related disease spectrum that's associated with it. So the older you are, the more likely you will experience a serious infection and a life-threatening infection. So the mortality rate, for example, in individuals above 80 is about 15%. And if you're below 20, the mortality rate is virtually non-existent, less than 0.01%.
So we have about 32 cases in North Carolina. Dr. Mandy Cohen, who's the secretary of North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services, says, I think things are moving exceptionally quickly, which is why we need to move exceptionally quickly as well, which leads to Dee on Instagram's question, where are all the confirmed cases around the state? Most, I think, Claire, are in Wake County. We're in that environment. Right?
Correct. Yeah. And actually this weekend, the State Department of Health and Human Services launched a COVID-19 count for North Carolina. And so you can actually go onto the NCDHHS website and see a map of where the cases are.
And where are the people who have this virus? Are they all at home, self-isolating?
Yes.
Is that smart?
According to health officials. That is the best practice in public health. I will defer to Dr. Barrick and Jonathan, if you guys, but I mean, that's the recommendation.
What do we know about the health of these people? How ill are they with this virus?
So I don't know that we know specifics, but what we do know is that if a Department of Public Health in any of the counties in North Carolina deem a person to go into self-isolation at home, then they don't require hospitalization. So if a patient requires hospitalization because they're having extreme difficulty breathing or need specific treatment, public health departments will refer them to the hospitals for inpatient admission. So if they're at home, they are more well than folks that would need to be admitted.
As in not in need of a ventilator or
– Or other you know, interventions that you would receive in the hospital.
Because the treatment for this, Dr. Barrick, is – there is no treatment for this. All you can do is – make them comfortable, as comfortable as possible. What are people? What is happening in hospital settings for people who come down with COVID-19?
So the most dangerous clinical symptoms are a disease called acute respiratory distress syndrome, and that's supported by respiratory support, either invasive or non-invasive, giving oxygen to the patient. And treating clinical symptoms so that they can stay alive. So the basic problem is that the lining of the alveoli in the lung breaks down and fluid pours in from the capillary bed into the lungs, and you, in essence, are drowning. And so clinical care is designed to keep the patient oxygenated, to support them in terms of their breathing, and try to prevent what's called hypoxia or lack of oxygen, which causes a multi-organ failure.
Chris emails, we keep being told to wash our hands. We've got that message loud and clear, he says. Is there anything else we can do to protect ourselves?
Social distancing.
Social distancing.
Define that.
So the coronavirus spreads easiest when you're in close contact with an individual that has a high likelihood of having the disease. And close contact is within 6 feet. And so if you can maintain a distance of 6 feet, that is considered sufficient to reduce some of your risk. And then avoid, like Dr. Barrick said, touching your face, touching surfaces, and then touching your face. So good cleaning practices around your workspace or in your home will also help.
Well, Jenna on Instagram says, how long can the virus survive on the surfaces around us, countertops, doorknobs, keyboards, telephones, etc.? How long do we know? Because I keep hearing varying answers to that question. 9 days, 5 days, a month. That's what I've heard. So what is the answer?
So I've read a little bit of the literature on this, and I think that the difficulty with a lot of the science around coronavirus is it's still evolving because it's very new. The last literature that I saw last week published by the NIH indicated that coronavirus on different non-porous surfaces could be around for a day or 2 days, if not wiped. I'd defer to Dr. Barrick if he's heard anything more.
Let me ask a question about washing your hands, Dr. Barrick. It's the things that you touch to turn the water on are non-porous surfaces, the handles that on the faucet. If you turn the faucet on to wash your hands and you sing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star twice, which is, I think, 20 seconds of washing your hands, and then you've rinsed off the water and then you touch the faucet handles, aren't you recontaminating yourself?
Use a paper towel. Use your elbows.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
A lot of faucets are motion activated.
So these viruses are not alive. They are not living organisms, but they can last – this virus can last on surfaces for a considerable amount of time. Why? If they're not alive and they have no host, how are they a threat?
So the latest research I've seen is that the virus can survive 5 days on surfaces. It depends on what matrix it's in. Are they alive or dead? The truth is they're inert and they're very much alive. And they begin replicating once they enter into a cell. I'm sorry, I missed the second part of your question.
I'm not sure what it was.
Does anybody?
Tom emails, I'm a regular lap swimmer. I know the virus survives on droplets. Do the chemicals in pools like chlorine destroy the virus?
Well, I know that our cleaning procedures for the equipment we use as first responders, we use a mixture of 1 to 10 bleach, which is very effective at viruses. However, I would caution you to not swim in a pool that is consistent of 1 to 10 bleach, as that might be very irritating. And so to speak largely to what composes a pool, we have seen literature that says it's not a waterborne disease. Mm-hmm. But then I would consider your exposure getting in and out of the pool using a shared locker room, all of the surfaces that are in a gym as part of your exposure outside of just the water that you're swimming in.
And one of the dirtiest things that all of us handle every single day, billions of times a day, are your cell phones, which cannot be cleaned with a lot of commercial cleaners. Apple is recommending that you can use Clorox wipes on your phone. Samsung has said nothing about how to clean your phone, but you should clean your phone.
Yeah, somehow. I just Cloroxed mine this morning.
But it's Clorox and some of the other cleaners that they're recommending you clean countertop surfaces and can damage your phone screen and the back of your phone and some of the ports in your phone. So read up on it because you don't want to waste a $400 phone or whatever is a terrible thing to waste. Barry emails, how many more weeks or months is it likely to be necessary for religious services, concerts, and other public gatherings to be canceled? And the self-quarantine period for COVID-19 is recommended to last 2 weeks. Is the total time of quarantine the time someone is symptomatic plus 2 weeks after the person is symptom-free, or is it 2 weeks from the start of symptoms? Let's start with the first part of that question. How long will we see these cancellations?
Well, the CDC just put out guidelines, excuse me, that said 8 weeks. So they're recommending that you limit gatherings larger than 50 people for the next 8 weeks. So I guess if your church is bigger than 50 people, it could be for a while.
And let's get back to the self-quarantine period, Dr. Barrick. Is it 2 weeks from the onset of symptoms? Because I think you can transmit this without even knowing you have it. What's the quarantine period? What is the point of it?
The incubation period between exposure and developing some sort of symptom is on average between 2 and 14 days with a mean of about 5 or 6 days.
But if you come through – if you come down with this virus and you come through it and you're well again, do you continue shedding virus particles that are contagious?
I think there's a couple of things that are really important to clarify on the first part of that question before we talk about virus shedding, and it's the difference between quarantine and isolation,
okay,
which was packed into that last listener question. And I think it's important for everybody to remember that we quarantine the well who have been exposed and we isolate the sick who have symptoms.
Okay.
And so they're two different periods in time. So if you have had a close contact exposure to somebody who has active COVID-19, you need to be quarantined for 14 days. If at the end of that 14-day period you don't have symptoms, the likelihood that you have the disease is very low. Now, once symptoms develop, then you need to be isolated to prevent you from transmitting that disease to other people. And that isolation period needs to last as long as clinically appropriate until you have overcome the disease. Typically, what they're saying is you need to have 2 negative tests within a 24-hour period.
How do you know if you get this? How do you know when you are no longer infectious? That's an email from Margie.
So I think you need to start with your decrease in symptoms. And then you need to consult with a clinician and get a test. And if the test is negative and it's negative twice, there's a good likelihood that you're overcome the disease and that you're not spreading virus. Now, again, the science behind this is all still very, very new. And they're looking at cases of relapse and reoccurrence. But the only place that information is coming from is China, because they're the only ones that are on the back half of this curve and able to learn those types of things.
Another listener question on Instagram. Explain the difference between stubborn and cautious and what that looks like with COVID-19. How scared should we really be versus just being smart and cautious, doctor?
Well, you definitely need to be smart and cautious. I agree with the earlier statement from Claire that the next 2 months are going to be very hard on the American public. We're going to see a rapid increase in cases. You need to be smart. You need to be cautious. Panic does you no good. In fact, it increases your risk. Pay attention to the health authorities. Pay attention to social distancing. Mm. Pay attention to your own health status.
Kathy, on our website, how will we know when we can go back to normal on coronavirus? Or is this forever? Is there a trigger or a metric we're waiting for? A decline in new cases? No new cases? A vaccine? If we get through this year, will it come back next year? If you get it, can you not get it again?
I think everybody wants to know the answer to all of those questions. It's pretty new. I don't know. You want to?
I think for a period of time, we're going to have to become comfortable with living with uncertainty because we have to learn about the virus and learn about the particular epidemiology of how the virus works in your community. Every community is going to be different depending on the mitigation actions they take today will help determine the length of time we have to change our behaviors in particular communities.
We may have already covered this, but Mark emails, why is this virus being handled differently with a matter of urgency and concern when other viruses were not? In other words, what makes this virus different and apparently so much more dangerous? Dr. Barrick.
Well, its high transmissibility is a huge problem. It also has a mortality rate that's calculated at 3%. The attack rate of the virus is between 20 and 30% most likely. That means on average 20% to 30% of the American public can be infected this year. You can do the math. The math is quite scary, and that's why implementing public health intervention strategies to flatten the curve is absolutely critical. I'd like to at least briefly mention what I think will happen with this based on the contemporary human coronaviruses. These all emerged about 100 to 800 years ago, and they're now primarily infections of children. In general, coronaviruses cause severe disease in adults and the elderly, and so the prediction would be that this virus would cause significant morbidity and mortality globally for up to 2 to 3 years, and then it would become an infection of children. Coronaviruses don't evolve rapidly like flu. They cause a transient infection primarily in children, and it's mild in children, so it'll become a childhood illness.
We are being told, things are closing left and right. New York City shut down all their restaurants. Many states have canceled school for the foreseeable future. We have moved up spring break in Mecklenburg County and added a week to it to give school officials a chance to figure out what they should be doing, what the response should be. We see Apple stores around the country closed, etc. And Maggie on Instagram wants to know how long this might last. And we are told that it's going to last for 8 weeks, 2 months.
Well, the CDC recommendation was gatherings larger than 50 people. That came down this weekend. Gatherings larger than 50 people should be postponed or canceled for the next 8 weeks.
But then I've heard estimates from governors talking on television over the weekend, 6 months.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's kind of at officials' discretion at this point. Everybody's kind of trying to wait and hear from the public health officials on what the best practice should be moving forward. I don't know where we'll be in 2 months.
Dr. Barrett, do health officials know where we'll be and they're just sugarcoating it by saying 8 weeks, but it's really going to be 6 months?
So the model is China and Korea, both of which implemented draconian public health intervention strategies. When they did that, they had increased cases for about a month, followed by a progressive decline in cases. I think China is averaging, as they move into their third month, they're averaging about 30 cases or so a day. Korea is not quite there yet, but it's almost there. And so you're looking at a 2 to 3 month window. Should the U.S. public government and public health community implement an aggressive intervention strategy.
So Christopher on email says or asks, on Saturday, my wife took her son, my stepson, he's 15, to urgent care at Novant in Huntersville due to a high fever for a flu test. He started feeling sick on Friday. Once the result of the flu test came back negative, the nurse suggested he get a coronavirus test since he met the criteria, high fever, shortness of breath, etc. We will not know the result of that test till Wednesday at the earliest, 3 to 4 business days. We are currently on lockdown until we hear the results. Neither myself nor my wife are showing any symptoms and therefore cannot be tested to see if we may have it. If he does have it, how likely is it we can get it? We have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk about that, because if somebody in your house has it and they're in self-isolation, what do you do to protect the health of everybody else in the house? It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Dr. Ralph Barrick, professor of epidemiology at UNC Chapel Hill, Jonathan Studnick, deputy director of medic and doctor of epidemiology, and Claire Donnelly, our healthcare reporter here at WFAE News. We're taking listener questions. We just read one from Christopher about taking his son, or stepson rather, to get a test at Huntersville for the flu. It turned out negative, and so they had him tested for COVID-19, and that test will come back on Wednesday. So in the meantime, what does the rest of the family do? Because his wife, he says, has been in constant contact with her son since he started feeling ill. He says, I've been keeping comfortable distance from my stepson, but I'm in close contact with my wife, but currently we are not kissing. What do you do if somebody comes down with, or you think they have the symptoms, or they actually have COVID-19? Somebody has to be the caregiver. What do you do in the house?
So I think this comes down to a question of preparedness. And over the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about preparedness in the community for a pandemic. And we've seen folks going out to the grocery store and buying up all the toilet paper and putting canned goods on the shelf. And what we need people to be thinking about is an answer to that question specifically. How are you preparing your household to have an individual live within it, isolated? And so it's best if you have a multiple room house to be able to isolate the individual in a single room. When they're in that room, they can exist just fine. If you need to interact with them, that person needs to put on a surgical mask or a face shield of some sort. You can need
the ill person.
The ill person needs to put on a surgical mask. Keep your distance as they go out of the room. If they need to go use the restroom, go into the restroom and then have that person wipe down all the surfaces and clean everything and go back to their room. If they need to be delivered food, leave food outside of their door. Let them know it's there. Have them open it up after you've left and take the food out. It's really difficult, and it's going to be difficult for people who have multiple folks in a one-room apartment or a small condo. But for those that have the ability, you can isolate safely if you follow some common sense practices around distancing.
When you get the normal flu, you don't feel good enough sometimes to walk to the bathroom. You feel so awful. So this is supposed to be worse on magnitudes of bad feeling. Really, can people get out of bed to pick up the food that's left outside the bedroom door and eat it and then put the food back and then clean all the surfaces in a bathroom? Are they going to be well enough to do that?
So you need to make smart choices as a person that's a caregiver for someone with this virus. And you're going to have to do the best as you can as a family member or a partner with that person. If that's not possible, you can wear a face shield yourself when you have to walk in and interact. That might lower your likelihood somewhat. I wouldn't recommend doing that all of the time. It's not very protective when you're out and about.
Everybody's talking about getting masks and washing your hands. What about gloves?
So gloves, if you're touching surfaces, so if you have to be the individual to clean up after someone that's isolated, if you wear gloves, you can limit the likelihood that you're then going to touch your face with dirty hands. Just don't touch your face with the gloves on. Wash your hands with soap and water when you're done cleaning, regardless of whether or not you're wearing gloves. And if you follow basic hygiene principles while taking care of patients, you can lower your risk. Now, it's not going to take your risk to zero because you are living with someone who has an infectious disease. And you don't have immunity to it. So the best you can do is take steps to lower your risk. You won't eliminate it.
Kevin on Facebook, has testing started happening in North Carolina to the level that would be sufficient for reporting an accurate number of infections? Claire?
No. So there's been an issue kind of from the get-go with CDC, with tests coming from the CDC. They were missing a chemical that you need to extract genetic material from the virus to check to make sure, or to check to see if there is the RNA from the virus in the sample. So that's been an issue in North Carolina. We don't have enough yet. LabCorp announced this weekend that they are going to have, or they anticipate that they will have 10,000, enough tests to test 10,000 people per day by the end of the week. But LabCorp serves the entire U.S.
So. Why are we so far behind the curve on this, Dr. Barrick?
This is a national tragedy, and it should never have happened. We had 2 months of knowledge about the sequence of this virus. The initial CDC rollout of the test was flawed. In terms of the primer sets that were used in the test,
why can't we use other countries' tests? I mean, other countries don't seem to have any problem getting these tests. We don't have them. Why can't we use theirs?
Well, the President of the United States refused the offer from the WHO to receive tests from the WHO,
and that can't be reversed. There's nobody who can reverse that decision. The President hasn't changed his mind on that decision yet.
I think the solution here in the U.S. was to try to fix the CDC tests and to begin to enable companies to begin preparing tests that would be CLIA certified that could be used in a hospital setting.
Kayla on Facebook, should gyms be closing? And here's a better question. Should you be going to the gym?
So at this point in time in this weird space that we're living in, it's all about assessing your personal risk and how much risk you want to take. The CDC provided that guidance yesterday about spaces with more than 50 people in them. I would not be inclined personally to walk into a space that has more than 50 people in it, whether that be a gym, a restaurant, or any other gathering spot.
But unless you go to a really high-end gym, gyms are notoriously not clean. And people, you know, they're on the equipment, they're sweating, they're picking up barbells, they're using the machines for your pecs and things like that. And
all of those things.
All of those are surfaces to capture virus.
And right? All of those things you say are true. And so in your life, as you navigate living in a pandemic environment, how are you going to assess your personal risk? There will be a time when more guidance is handed out at the local, state, and federal level. And as that guidance is coming, we all have our own responsibility to make good choices.
Art emails, is there anything a person can do during the period of time between getting infected and getting sick or very sick to lessen the severity of the disease? Dr. Barrick.
Well, that's a great question. I do not have an answer for that question.
Larry emails, I'm almost 85, so I pay attention every time I'm told that seniors are very vulnerable to this virus. But are we?
Yes.
Why?
Dr. Barrick mentioned it already. There's been good research out of China and now coming out of Europe that demonstrates there is a high mortality rate for those individuals over the age of 65. Those folks over the age of 65 need to take this very seriously, start practicing social distancing today, and be very careful in their contact with others.
We have closed schools in certain states around the country. North Carolina has yet to mandate the closing of schools. Schools in Charlotte are closed right now for spring break and with an additional week tacked on. And Ann wants to know, should we expect the schools to be closed longer than 2 weeks? Does anybody know?
So the governor did close schools on Saturday statewide for 2 weeks. Yes, we did.
For 2 weeks.
Okay. Yeah, he made a press briefing on Saturday. They're closed for 2 weeks. And I think the language in that closing is very important. He said a minimum of 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so that allows us opportunity to evaluate what we need to do for our kids if schools need to be closed longer.
You just said very emphatically when the 85-year-old questioned whether he was really in danger, you said yes immediately. Jill emails, I keep hearing that children aren't affected by the coronavirus, but what do we know about infants? I have a four-month-old baby who has never been sick, so he has not built up his immune system yet. I also worry about pregnant friends and their babies when they are born. Dr. Barrick, what do we know about that?
Well, we know children and infants have very high titer in their upper respiratory tract and lower respiratory tract. We know that there's been very, very few, if any, cases of mortality in infants and young children, unless they had some sort of underlying comorbidity, respiratory function, cardiac function, or some other clinical manifestation that made them more vulnerable to serious disease. In general, they get sick, they have serious pneumonia in their lungs, but they don't act sick, they don't look sick, and they recover.
Hmm. What about restaurants? We don't want them to go out of business, and we know that people shouldn't go out to eat. I mean, Devin Nunes, the representative from California, was on Fox News over the weekend, and he said, what you can do to help if you're healthy and your family is healthy is go to a restaurant and have a meal out. Is that wise?
I mean, it kind of goes back to the – I don't know if that was before or after the CDC put out the more than 50 people guidance. But I think – I mean, use your, you know, best judgment, I would say. Also, takeout is a great option.
What about
delivery?
Well, we have an email about takeout. Elena on Facebook, has the question been asked about takeout from restaurants? Is it safe? Because – somebody has to handle the food. They have to handle the containers. They have to handle the bag it's put in. You have to walk into the restaurant to get it. Or if you're having it delivered, they have to hand it to you or put it on your doorstep. What about that?
You know, 6 weeks ago, I saw an image come out of China that had a delivery food with an order receipt on it. And on the receipt, it had the temperature of the driver. It had the temperature of the cook that prepared the food. And I looked at that image and I said, wow, what a world they're living in. I can't imagine that happening here. And now that doesn't seem so silly to ask those questions about the health of those people that are preparing food and delivering food. And we live in a different time right now where we have to be a little bit more aware of our surroundings. And a little bit more aware of our interactions with people.
Just a general comment from Eliza on Facebook. I work in a call center as a health benefits consultant, and people all over the country are calling to get some kind of coverage in place. You know things are getting serious when healthy people in their 20s are willingly calling to get health insurance. D on Instagram, if they tell me to stop going to work, how will I get paid and be able to pay my rent and other bills? The president announced a bunch of stuff over the weekend. The federal government stepping in certain situations. Does it cover everybody?
I mean, I think that that's kind of an ongoing process, right? That's a question that everybody's kind of waiting to see, what systems can be put in place to protect those people.
Okay.
I believe there's a loophole for large companies that employees who are employed in like Amazon or Walmart are not covered by that package.
Angela on Facebook says, please encourage healthy people to donate blood. We have a lot of drives canceling and need people to continue to give to maintain the blood supply. You're a medic person. Is that a good idea?
So I think that if the answer to that question is if you're healthy, you're certain you haven't been exposed. And, there's a lot of services that we need to continue to figure out how we're going to operate. Blood drives, blood donations are important. So is feeding the hungry. So is sheltering the homeless. So is providing services to other disadvantaged in our communities. And we might have to do that differently for some period of time.
Jonathan, I think this one needs to go to you. If someone believes they have the virus and needs to call medic for transport to the hospital, what information should they be giving to 911?
Thank you for that question, Mike. And I'm going to answer it in two parts. First part, if you do have an emergency and you need to call 911, please do. And we'll talk about that process. If you just have a fever and a cough and you're not short of breath, try to seek care some other way through your physician, phone line, through a nurse advice line, or through telehealth. But if you
how do you get through to all those things?
So start with your physician's office and ask for their nurse advice line. Get those numbers on your fridge. This is all part of preparedness today. Investigate through your health insurance. What other types of options for remote care do you have? And those folks, like the woman talking on the phone, they're the experts in guiding you through care to make sure you can access care in different ways. Now, if you do feel like you're having an emergency and you call 911, we'll ask for your telephone number, your address as normal, your chief complaint. And then once we identify what your chief complaint is, we're going to ask you three questions. We're going to ask you if you have a fever, if you have a cough or shortness of breath, and if you have done any international travel in the last 14 days. And we're going to do that to make our responders aware of whether or not when they respond, they need to put on a respirator in order to come evaluate you.
And you've said that you at Medic are prepared, meaning what?
So for the last 3 weeks, we've been working with our first responder partners, County Public Health, Mecklenburg County, and the City of Charlotte, to review and update our pandemic response plans to make sure that we have a good indication of the personal protective equipment that we need to keep our responders safe, to be current on the most up-to-date research and guidelines from the CDC as it relates to care and response, and to start answering and asking some of the tough questions in the community about how to respond, not just as a first responder, but globally as a community.
In New Rochelle, New York, where they seem to have a confined outbreak and a severe one in the New York City metropolitan area, nurses, public health nurses, are going door to door and knocking on doors in protective gear to ask if people need help. Is that an extraordinary case? Has Mecklenburg County made plans to do that, if need be?
And so what I would ask folks based on those extreme measures is, what have you done today to flatten the curve of this epidemic so that we don't need to take the extreme measures that we see in other communities?
Can you boost your immune system, Dr. Barrick, in advance of this? Is there any point in that? Quickly.
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. Dr. Ralph Barrick, professor of epidemiology at the Gilling School of Public Health, working on this virus as we speak at UNC Chapel Hill. Jonathan Studnick, deputy director of Medic and a doctor of epidemiology. And Claire Donnelly, our healthcare reporter here at WFAE News. Thank you all for joining us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.